Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Talladega, Alabama, you're in the Pit Stop with Tim Bespan and Stephen Wilson, home of the 2.66-mile, 33-degree bank monster we call Talladega Super Speedway. And before we get started tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I want to give a big thanks to Talladega Super Speedway, Talladega Short Track, everybody that's helped out with the show and everything. Brace yourself, Mr. Paul Cleveland out of Australia with his safety devices. And right now, the past few weeks, we've had some bad stuff come out of the professional sports, you know, not only just NASCAR, but Mr. Tony Gwynn, Major League Baseball, lost his battle with cancer at age 54. And legendary engine builder Mr. Ray Fox lost his life not too long ago. And I just want to send our condolences and prayers out to the family and friends of, you know, it wasn't too long ago, Mr. Junie Dunleavy. It's just... just a sad time in our sport, not even, you know, NASCAR, but professional sports with Tony Gwynn losing his battle with cancer at age 54. At this time, ladies and gentlemen, let's bow our heads. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive them that trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. And this is our good friend, Ms. Donna Elkins from Talladega Super Speedway, with our national anthem. Okay, NASCAR fans and motorsport fans abroad, let's bring on my good friend Stephen Wilson, my good sidekick. Mr. Stephen, how's it going tonight, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself tonight?
Oh, we're doing good, Stephen. A little bit warm down here in Dega. I'm sure it's a little bit warm up that way, too, isn't it?
Yeah. It's about 97, 98 degrees. Tomorrow, talking about 100-plus with the heat index. It'll be the first time over 100 this year.
Woo, that's a little bit warmer than it is here. You know, we got, which I think it topped maybe 91, 92 here, but we got the humidity and everything. And me and you and talked earlier, you know, we got a little bit of spare time before our guest, Mr. Jim Baldwin, was a hauler driver for Dale Earnhardt Sr. He's a good friend of mine now. Me and him have become pretty close, and that's at 7:20 Eastern time. And then we've got Mr. Tom Jensen from Fox Sports coming on at 7:30 Eastern. We're going to roll Jim over in with him. And, Stephen, if you would, let me read this this from NASCAR, and then we'll do what me and you were talking about earlier. We'll cover some post-race stuff from the NASCAR Camp World Truck Series, Nationwide Series, and you're going to do the trucks. I'll do the Nationwide, and I'll let you cover the cup. But, yeah, this is a press release from NASCAR about passing of Ray Fox. This is from Daytona Beach, Florida, June 16, 2014. Famed NASCAR engine builder, car owner, and official Ray Fox died Sunday at the age of 98. Born May 28, 1916, Fox made his name in NASCAR as an engine builder, winning Mechanic of the Year in 1956 after the crash of 300 cars he built for Carr Kiehoffer. I probably messed that up. Won 22 of season's first 26 races. Fox has been nominated for induction into the NASCAR Hall of Fame each of the past 3 years. In 1960, he built the Chevrolet in which NASCAR Hall of Famer Junior Johnson won the Daytona 500. NASCAR Hall of Famer David Pearson won 3 times that year driving Fox-built Pontiac. Fox, who served in the U.S. Army during World War II, transitioned to a car owner in 1962. He won 14 races in his NASCAR career, included 9 with Junior Johnson and 2 with NASCAR Hall of Famer Buck Baker. Baker's 1964 Southern 500 win came in a car owned by Fox. Others who competed in Fox's cars include NASCAR Hall of Famer Cale Yarber, Fred Lorenzen, Buddy Baker, and Charlie Glossbach. Fox retired in the early 1970s, but in 1990 accepted the role of NASCAR's engine inspector, a position he held until his second retirement at the age of 80 in 1996. NASCAR issued the following statement regarding Fox's passing. Ray Fox is one of the individuals who helped form the foundation of our sport, with a personality that was every bit as important as his own track accomplishments. His place in our record book is secure, but no one should ever view Ray Fox solely in terms of statistics. A resident of Daytona Beach, Florida, he was a hometown hero of sorts, serving as ambassador for NASCAR in the community where the sport began. Most importantly, he was a friend to us all. Several years ago, he said he could still build a competitive NASCAR Sprint Cup Series engine. If he had indeed been asked, in all likelihood, he would have delivered. Of course, Ray Fox had already delivered in accomplishments and memories that will forever serve NASCAR well. Sad time in our sport, Stephen.
Yeah, it is. And we've got another passing I heard about earlier today. Terry Parsons, the wife of Benny Parsons, her mother died earlier this morning in Daytona Beach also.
Golly, sorry to hear about that. But our fans and friends, condolences and prayers go out to their family also. And Stephen, you know, me and you talk, is there anything you want to throw out before we get started about some of the post-race stuff?
No, we don't really have much going on. This weekend we're going to go to 2 road courses, one in Road America with the Nationwide Series and the Sonoma Raceway with the Sprint Cup Series.
Okay. And Stephen, if you want to start, if you want to cover some of the post-race stuff from the NASCAR Camp World Truck Series, driven for Lyman 250 at Gateway Motorsports Park, if you want to go ahead with that, you can, and then I'll come after, whenever you get done, I'll come back with the Nationwide Series stuff.
Yeah, so this weekend, Gateway Motorsports Park reopened this weekend with the Camping World Truck Series. It's the first time since 2009 that the NASCAR Series have been at that track. They did fairly well, by the way, it looked on TV. I'm sure there were some holes in the crowd, but they'll go along a little bit as they go along. They'll be able to build that up out there, not a problem. But Darrell Wallace Jr., he won his second race in the Camping World Truck Series in his 29th start. Herman Carovo finished second, Timothy Peters third, Chase Pistone. He actually finished ninth. He was the highest finishing rookie out there of the race. And leading out of there, Johnny Sauter leads teammate Matt Crafton by 10 points in the Camp World Truck Series point standings.
Okay, that sounds good, Stephen. And I'll take over with the NASCAR Nationwide Series. Race report number 13, 23rd annual Ole's Bargain Outlet 250 from Michigan International Speedway. Brooklyn, Michigan, June 14, 2014, a 2 mile oval, 125 laps, 250 miles. Let me scroll down here. Sunoco Rookie of the Year contender bonus points includes winner, lap, leader, and most laps. Oh, that's some more stuff. Okay. Failed to qualify. Four cars failed to qualify. Number 67, Benny Gordon. Number 76, anyway. 46, Matt DiBenedetto, and Morgan Shepherd did not qualify. Paul Menard won the Ole's Bargain Outlet 250, his second NASCAR Nationwide Series victory prior to the start of the race. The following cars dropped to the rear of the field for the reasons indicated. Number 70 and 87, unimproved adjustments. Number 4, backup car. Number 67, a driver change. Time of the race is 1 hour, 47 minutes, 29 seconds. Average speed, 139.557 miles an hour. Margin of victory was 0.468 seconds. The Coors Light Pole Award went to Mr. Kyle Busch at 193.242 miles an hour, 37.259 seconds. The 3M lap leader, Kyle Larson, 46 laps. Duralast Brakes, break in the race award went to Paul Menard. The Maul Clevet engine builder of the race went to Joe Gibbs Racing Engine, number 54. Mobile One driver of the race was Mr. Kyle Larson. Enough said about Kyle. Kyle or something. Sunoco Rookie of the Race was Chase Elliott. Caution flags. There was 4 caution laps for 22 laps. Lap leaders. 14 lead changes among 6 drivers. And go ahead, Stephen. You got the Cup side.
So the Cup Series was at Michigan this weekend. Jimmy Johnson pulled off his third win of the season out there. This is his 69th. Victory in the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series in 450 starts. And actually, it's his first victory. It's his 10th top 10 in 25 races there at Michigan International. Also, this is Hendrick Motorsports' 5th consecutive victory and 3rd time that they've accomplished this feat. They did it twice in 2007 with a streak of 6-plus wins. Kevin Harvick, he finished second out there. He was coming on strong there at the end. Looks like he's been doing that every single week. And Kyle Larson, 8th, finishing the highest rookie of the race. Jeff Gordon left with point standings leader by 15 points over Jimmy Johnson.
Sounds good, my friend. We've covered all 3 series, and I want to give a big shout-out to my good friend, Mr. Will Kimmel. Believe it or not, I'm getting a wedding invitation from him. I don't know if we'll make it in Indiana, but I'll probably send him a wedding gift. Will is engaged, ladies. So Mr. Will Kimmel is off the table. He's getting married. But anyway, big shout. I think he finished 6th. I can't remember. He had some problems. But anyway, Stephen, we got a little bit of time, and I want to say that our good friend Tina Stoll has popped in here, and we want to bring Tina on. Well, we're going to bring her on with Tony, but she came on early. Let's bring her on. I can't find my book. Hey, Miss Tina Stoll, you're in the pit stop. Tennis player Stephen Wilson. How you doing tonight, sweetie?
I'm doing great. I called in early because I just wanted to hear you're all part of the show. I find
it interesting. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. And maybe you and Stephen can talk later. You know, me and Stephen's been tied up and all that. But is there anything you want to throw out before you come back on with Tony? Tina, about
Loving to hear the recap of your guys' racing because I hadn't gotten around to looking it up yet. So I'm just sitting back here in the peanut gallery.
Okay. That sounds good, Tina. And I want to thank you again for being a part of the Speedway Digest Radio Network and doing your NHRA stuff. And I throw you back over into mute, and if you want to just listen, we'll wait for Tony, and we'll let you and Tony have the floor whenever Tony's segment comes up. Everything open wheel.
That sounds good to me.
All right. Thanks, Tina.
Sure.
Stephen, the number to call in, ladies and gentlemen, 215-383-3681, and we won't just answer questions about NASCAR. We got Miss Tina Stoll. She's on the She's on the side over here. If you have a question about NHRA, she's Miss NHRA. And, Stephen, I want to bring on Todd Bigsby. This is our number one fan, number one follower. We're going to bring Todd on and see what Todd is. Todd, you're in the pit stop with Tim Spain and Stephen Wilson. What's going on tonight, my friend?
Hey, guys. Enjoying this hot weather.
Yeah, I know it. Steven said it was bumping 100 up there with him today.
Oh, man, I feel bad for him. It was, I know, in the 90s here, and, of course, I fired up both ACs.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, our good friend Tim Campbell, our weatherman out of Stillwater, Oklahoma, every time he comes on, he's talking about putting some snow on Steven and all that up there. But anyway, Todd, you got the floor, bud. If you want to ask Stephen any questions, you know, Stephen knows a lot more about this than I do. I just know enough to keep me alive. You got the floor, Todd. You and Stephen.
Stephen, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing pretty good. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. Now, we know some of the guys like the road courses. We know some of them don't. Which, my favorite driver, he does not. So I don't think he'll do well. Of course, my pick was wrong, guys, I have to say. What do you think the biggest thing that they're going to be worried about coming to their road course?
Well, one of the biggest things is a lot of these drivers out here, they have very limited experience on the road courses as they come up through the series. So, you know, you're going to have guys out there that, like Tony Stewart, Casey Kane, that have road course experience from racing open wheel. You also, of course, we're going to have the road course ringers out there again this weekend, so we should see some of them do fairly well. You know, and Marcos Ambrose, he's another guy out there that I think we're going to have he'll have a good, strong showing out there like he does also at Watkins Glen. You know, unfortunately, like I say, you know, a lot of these guys coming up through the series, there's very limited road course driving that they do unless they're coming over from something like the Open Wheel Series or, you know, now it's SCCA or, you know, anything like that. The biggest thing that in the last few years that even the K&N series has started going to a couple of road courses, they run at Virginia International Raceway here in Virginia. So that kind of gives, you know, some of these guys a little bit of hands-on experience where they wouldn't normally get. And I think that's what you're going to have to see a little bit more of to get some of these guys in a better position. But, you know, when they're running 95, 98% of the track on oval courses, you know, they're going to be strong. You know, because they've done that for so long. And without having a diversified track out there with the road courses in the lower series where Nationwide only goes to one. Camping Truck Series is going to return to one, I believe it is this year, if I remember correctly, if not next year. So until you get that in the lower series, these guys are just going to continue to struggle out there. You're going to have your good drivers, but, you know, you're going to have the Marcos Ambrose and the Tony Stewarts out there that's going to be able to put on a better show just because of their experience.
Yeah, because I know at Watkins Glen, you know, Kyle Busch was a really good competitor there. And now, like Sonoma, it's kind of, in a way, kind of like Watkins Glen, because there is a downhill turn, and from what I've seen in previous years, when they hit that curve on that downhill, somebody gets into somebody, so it always brings out the excitement.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you've got the uphill down here and the left and right that these drivers have to contend with out there. I'm not a road course expert by any means. As everybody else has grown up on the oval track. So I know the oval track's a lot better. I'm not much of a fan of road course racing. I know there's a lot of people out there that are a fan of road course racing. Unfortunately, I'm just not one of them, and I guess I can't consider myself a road course expert by any means.
Now, I grew up, you know, being around the Glen, and out of all honesty, I kind of agree with you there on that, because the only thing that I didn't like about road courses is you can't see the whole track. you got to watch the jumbotrons, and then by the time you're watching that, by the time you take your eyes off from that back to the track in front of you, they're already going by.
Well, I mean, that's about indicative as it is at Daytona or even Talladega. If you're sitting on the front stretch, they look like little micro cars running around the back. You have no clue who they are anywhere unless you're watching the jumbotron the entire time. So, but I don't think that's so much, you know, what people are so concerned about. I think, you know, a lot of people grow up around the oval track all their lives, and they really just, you know, don't have that warm, fuzzy feeling for road courses. And I can kind of throw myself in that because I have no road courses near me other than VIR, and they very rarely race anything out there.
Right. Now, just so you guys know, I do have a special for tonight. I have a house full of people over, and I have it on speakerphone so everybody can hear the show.
Well, thanks for bringing all your friends over and listening in tonight.
Anything I can do to help promote this show and make it bigger and better, I'm going to do everything in my power that I can.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much,
Todd.
We owe you more. Yeah. Todd, we definitely appreciate it. Todd, I'll throw you over in mute. We've got Stephen coming on right now. We've got we're gonna call him a legendary hauler driver, Mr. Jim Baldwin, driver for Dale Sr. Whenever Dale was racing, and I'm gonna bring Jim Baldwin on, and I got a button that I'm gonna mash whenever I bring Jim on because I know he's really gonna
Let's get ready to.
Mr. Jim Baldwin, you're in the pit stop with Tim Despain and Stephen Wilson. How you doing tonight, my friend, in Charlotte?
Oh, I'm doing great here in Charlotte. How are you and Stephen doing?
We're doing good. We're doing real, real great. And I'm glad that you took the time out of your busy schedule, Jim. You know, last time we tried to have you on, we had some broadcast issues and all that. But I have got to talk to you a lot.
I think you lost your headset.
Yeah, everything was going on. It was just a bad night, Jim. But, yeah, and Suzanne told me, she said, you need to get Mr. Baldwin back on. I said, yes, ma'am, I will. But, Jim, I want to introduce you to my good friend and CEO of Speedway Digest, Mr. Stephen Wilson from Martinville, Virginia. And I'm sure he has a few questions for you, if that's okay with you.
That's fine. How you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing fairly well. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing great.
Good. So you worked for many years for Richard Childress Racing, driving the number 3 hauler all across the country, getting the car and the equipment out there. What do you feel is the toughest part of your job being the hauler driver out there week in and week out on the road?
A lot of times, Stephen, it was, especially on the West Coast deals and everything, it was just the short time that you had at the shop getting everything switched over, because you know, from racetrack to racetrack, you have to switch all your control arms. Everything has got to be changed from one track to the other. And the short time that you've had switching everything over, and then like going to Sears Point, Fontana, and all this, you know, that was the toughest part, those real long hauls where you had only one day to get your truck changed out.
And I know, you know, NASCAR has kind of changed up the schedule a little bit, and a lot of it is now they're starting here on the East Coast, and they're working their way out to the West Coast just to come back. Is that something that NASCAR could take a look at the schedule and say, well, you know, these guys, they're having to crawl across the country 3,500 miles out there. Is there something you think they can do with the scheduling to make it easier on the hauler drivers out there?
Yes, I do, Stephen. I think, we go to Daytona, then we leave Daytona, we go to Phoenix, then we go to Vegas, then we come home, and we're here on the East Coast for 1 week, and then we turn around and go right back to Fontana. I wish they would do the Phoenix, the Vegas, and then Fontana, and then when we came home, we'd be on the East Coast for a long time. It would make it so much easier and so much less expensive.
And for what a lot of people may not realize this is that you drove the hauler back home from Daytona. And there is, you know, that was a sad experience for everybody in Daytona. Can you kind of just talk about that a little bit, you know, what you went through as a hauler driver and, you know, back at the shop and how that affected you and how it affected everybody at RCR in the coming days and years after that that happened?
Well, it was naturally it was a tragic thing that happened that day in Daytona. And, you know, I don't really think it sunk in on me totally. I got out of the racetrack that night about 9:30, and they gave me a police escort out to I-95, which I didn't go up I-95. I didn't want to get out in all that traffic and everything with what had went on. So I run 92 over to DeLand, Florida, and run the old Route 17 and came out up there north of Jacksonville before I got back on 95. Well, the time I got back on 95, there was very little traffic at all. And so I just really, I stepped it up, and I had to welcome North Carolina in a hurry when I got on 95, because I wanted to get there before the rush hour traffic in Charlotte and everything. And I got there just after daybreak at the shop there the next morning, and I think that's when it sunk in on me, because it was very difficult to even get into our race shop. All the TV satellite trucks and all the fans and everything, the road was about blocked. And so it took me a little bit to even get back down and get pulled into the truck bay there at the shop. So I think that's when it sunk in on me. When I turned in there to the race shop and saw all these people and all the TV and everything there, I think that's when it hit.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you coming on tonight and talking about that. I think Tim's got a couple questions for you also. You know, it really was a tragic thing that happened down there. And, you know, I guess it made your job a little bit tougher that you were the one that had to bring the car back home, you know, for everybody, you know, there at the shop.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, and I had probably six or seven of the transport drivers on the other trucks that had backup drivers with them, which I didn't. And, you know, several of them volunteered and said, you know, listen, if you need to go home, you can get on a plane and we'll take the truck back for you. I said, no. I said, Earnhardt wouldn't want anybody driving his truck but me. I'm taking it back. So
amen.
Amen,
Jim. And, Jim, I want to thank you. I didn't know if you wanted to really talk about that, but, you know, a lot of my friends, since Mr. Earnhardt lost his life, have really sort of backed off of the sport. But, you know, you can always if and but everything, Jim. You know that. And, you know, Dale Sr., I was not a big fan of, but he paved the way for everything NASCAR. Now, I would probably name him Mr. NASCAR, and I would probably name you Mr. NASCAR hauler driver, Jim. But thank you for talking about that. But anyway, Jim, I don't want to get into that because I know that's a touchy situation for you, and I'm glad you, you know, let Stephen ask you that question and, you know, talk about that, because there's a lot of fans that, you know, just like 9/11, they say everybody can. I remember exactly where I was when 9/11 come about. Well, I remember exactly where I was that Sunday afternoon here in Talladega, Alabama. I'm still a lineman for the co-op, but I'm not working as a lineman. I'm pushing a pencil now. I was up. We had some outages come through. We've been out working, and I won't never forget it. We had a pole down, and a lot of people might not understand what I'm talking about. We had cut the wire and folded it back that way we could get the pole up, and we got these few houses back on because it just went across the railroad track over to a church, and all that was dead. Well, we got the pole back up, and I set up over at the pole at the last house right there. We was right there in East of Boca, Alabama. And my good friend and crew chief, Aaron Aaron Pate was going to open the cutout up where I could put that wire back together. That way I wouldn't pick up nothing. And some of my guys on the ground said, there's 5 or 10 laps left in the Daytona 500. Can we wait and watch it? I said, yeah. You know, Alan, tell them, you know, we'll just 5 minutes ain't going to hurt nothing, you know, till we,
yeah.
you know, kill it where I can put it back together. And that's, you know, you people remember where you were whenever something like that happens. And I remember exactly where I was, Jim.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we remember things like that. We definitely do.
Especially when it's an iconic man like that. And, Jim, I know your time is limited, but we've got Tom Jensen should be coming on here in a minute. I know Tom probably has some questions for you. But a lot of our fans don't realize what a hauler driver does as far as his job, you know, as far as you don't just drive the hauler and get the car to the track and then just sit back and watch. You have other duties, correct?
Oh, yeah, you have a lot of duties, Tim, a bunch of duties. You got to be a truck driver. You got to be a parts man. You got to be a babysitter. you got to be a utility guy. You've got to do everything. After you get in the groove and get going, it all just falls in place for you because you know every week what you got to do, and you know what racetrack you're going to next. So when you get in there Monday morning and start switching everything, it just comes natural, and it just you just do it, and you don't think anything about it.
Yes, sir.
But
it's
a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Everything.
Yes, sir. I understand. It's a lot more work than a lot of the fans think of. And Jim and Steven, I want to bring on. We've got Mr. Tom Jensen from Fox Sports. I want to bring him on, and he agreed to stay on. Let's get him
ready to rumble!
I love that button for some reason. Hey, Mr. Tom Jensen, you're in the pit stop. Tim Spain and Stephen Wilson, CEO of Speedway Digest, and Mr. Jim Baldwin, Dale Sr.'s hauler driver. How you doing tonight, bud?
I'm good. How are
I'm
you
doing
boys tonight?
Yeah. How you
doing,
Bob?
We're doing good.
I think it's been a long time since I've seen you.
Yeah, it probably has been a long time.
Everything
going all right?
Yeah. Oh, it's going great. How's everything going with you?
Good. Busy as always, getting ready to head to Sonoma. Looking forward to that. Always one of the best trips of the year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're headed to Sonoma, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. In the morning, I'm headed to Road America.
Oh, nice. That ought to be a fun weekend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Jim, Stephen, if it's okay with you, Stephen, we'll let Tom Jensen and Jim Baldwin have the floor and let them talk about some old times, or let Tom ask some questions to Jim. Is that okay with you, Stephen?
Oh yeah, that's fine with me.
Okay, all right.
Okay,
Jim,
Tom,
you and Tom,
you got any questions?
Y'all got the floor.
Okay, Tom, go ahead.
Jim, you were seniors hauler driver.
Yes, uh-huh, yeah.
From when?
I started there in January of 1990, and I came off the road as a full-time driver of that truck at the end of 07, which Harvick was driving.
Okay.
17 years I drove that truck.
That's a lot of years behind the wheel. What's your favorite memory of Dale Sr.?
Well, his personality and the way he was with us and everything is one of my best memories. And, of course, the best memory I have is even I was there for four of his championships, but when we won the Daytona 500, that was my favorite memory because he was absolutely ecstatic. We had came so close so many times and didn't get it. Then when we finally got it, I mean, he was still around there at 11 o'clock that night in his fire suit riding around in golf cart hollering and, you know, hooping it up and carrying on.
That was an amazing
moment. That's one of my favorites.
can understand why. You know, my last lengthy interview with him came at Richmond in 2000, and it was in the middle of all the safety controversy, because the week before at Darlington, Bobby Labonte had pancaked the wall pretty hard in qualifying, and it was shortly after Adam Petty and Kenny Irwin died in separate crashes at New Hampshire. And I got to Richmond Friday morning, and J.R. Rhodes, his PR guy, came up to me and says, "Dale wants to see you in the holler right now." And I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? Because Dale never wanted to see me. And I go in the holler, and there's myself, David Poole from the Charlotte Observer, Monty Dutton from the Gaston Gazette, and a guy by the name of Henry Miller out of Indianapolis. And we sit there, and we look at each other, and, you know, one of us asks the other, "Do you know why we're here?" And no, nobody knew why we were there. And all of a sudden, Earnhardt comes into the holler, and he kind of runs in. And he comes up, and he sticks his nose, like, right into mine. And then he goes and sticks his nose right in the faces of the other three guys. And he turns around to JR, and he says in a real loud voice, he said, "Damn it, JR, I told you to get me the four biggest riders in the racing, not the four effing fattest asses." And
oh God, that
we didn't know what to say. We just, you know, most guys would say something like that to you, you'd be insulted, and we all started laughing. And we sat and talked with him for about an hour on about safety. And, you know, one of the first things he said was, "You know what? What I think of guys who say the sport's too dangerous, I think they should tie a kerosene ankle or a kerosene rag around their ankle so the ants don't crawl up their leg and chew their candy asses off." And, you know, 6 months later, he was dead. And it's a very poignant memory to go through that, to think about that. And earlier that year at Michigan, we were up there, and, you know, he was running really good in the 2000 season after a couple of years of, frankly, not running that well. And he had just re-signed Steve Park at DEI, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Kelly was pregnant with his first grandchild. And, you know, somebody asked him, "How are you?" And he said, "I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life. We're running good. I'm about to be a grandfather. DEI's taken off. You know, my son's doing well. Everything's as good as it can be." And, you know, the only thing, I know the sport still misses him terribly, and we all do, everybody who knew him, but the one consolation you can kind of take away from it is he was at a point in his life where he was very happy, and I think he'd done just about everything the driver could do. So.
Yeah, that's true, Tom. He was down at the Daytona 500 that year, in the 2 weeks before the race, he was in a totally different mood than what he'd ever been in speed weeks before. He'd always been intense, you know, and he won more races at Daytona than anyone.
Right.
But he was loose that speed weeks, the whole 2 weeks down there. He was just loose and happy-go-lucky and having a big time. He was just totally different that year. And even the race morning, he was just loose and laughing and, you know, carrying on, having a big time. And we had a great chance here to win that race and win the championship that year. But it all ended there that day, so. But he was in a different mood that speed weeks.
Yep. He was a tremendous talent. And I'll tell you my other favorite Earnhardt story. When Tony Stewart was a rookie and did the Indy 500 Coca-Cola 600 double, he raced at Indy, finished ninth, I believe, and took a helicopter and landed in the infield at Charlotte Motor Speedway. Gets out of the helicopter to go run to the bathroom in what used to be the ARCA garage there in the infield. And he goes, takes a few steps, and Jeff Gordon comes up and shakes his hand takes a few more steps, and Jeff Bodine walks by. They were going to driver introductions. Jeff Bodine walks by and shakes his hand, and he walks past Earnhardt. Earnhardt puts his arm around Tony's waist and picks him up and gives him noogies, rubs the top of his head like he's a 12-year-old kid who just hit the winning home run in Little League. And Tony had the most shocked expression I've ever seen on his face. So he runs the he finishes third or fourth, and it was a brutally hot night. And Tony didn't pay much attention to nutrition, and he got sick in the car, threw up all over himself in the car. And still, you know, to go almost 1,100 miles and finish third or fourth in the 600 as a rookie is unheard of. And he pulls up to the gas pumps, which is where you stop then in those days, and he basically passes out in his car. And we're all crowded around. There's TV cameras. There's print reporters. There's just a million people. And like I said, it's brutally hot. And all of a sudden, Earnhardt walks up. And that was, if you remember, that was also Junior's first Cup start. Earnhardt walks up, and he's walking toward the car, and we've all got our backs to him. And he never says a word, but somehow it's like we could sense it. And everybody kind of stepped aside, and Earnhardt walks in like the Marlboro Man, reaches down, undoes Tony's belts, pulls him out of the car, sets him down on the side, leans into his ear, whispers something, and then slaps him in the face lightly and walks away laughing. And about 5 years later, I was up in Indianapolis, and I was in Tony's holler talking to him. And I said, "Tony, I got to ask you." He said, "You remember the first year you ran the double?" He goes, "Of course. How could I not remember it?" I said, "Well, you know, you were passed out. You were sick. It was hot." He goes, no, I remember it." I said, "All these years, Tony, I've been dying to ask you, what in the heck did Earnhardt say to you when he pulled you out of the car?" And Tony got this kind of wistful, faraway look in his eye, and he just looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Two words: had enough." And that is so, you know, that is so quintessential Earnhardt. That's his way.
That was totally Earnhardt.
That's his way of showing respect.
Yes,
he walks over, grabs him, pulls him out of the car, slaps him, and says, "Had enough," and walks away. But that was him saying, "Young man, that was a job well done."
Yeah. That's exactly right, Tom. Sure is. He was a piece of work.
Well, okay. Yes, he was, y'all. Tom, Mr. Earnhardt was definitely a piece of work. And Stephen, do you have any questions for Mr. Tom Jensen while we've got this has been a real good conversation just sitting back and listening. You know, my God, I got chill bumps on my arms. Stephen, you want anything you want to ask Tom or Jim, go ahead, bud.
Yeah, this is Stephen. I got one question for Tom. You've been around the sport for quite some time. You've covered a lot of races out there, not only for Speed, but now for Fox Sports and Fox Sports One. How have you changed in the advent of the years of social media out there, being able to get that quick on the draw kind of news out there? How has that changed your reporting in the way that you do your job week in and week out?
Oh, it's completely changed. When I started doing NASCAR full-time in 1997, I was executive editor of a publication called Winston Cup Scene, which sadly is now defunct. But, you know, you go to the track on the weekends, and you'd spend Friday, Saturday, Sunday writing, and you'd be back in the office Monday or traveling Monday, and the paper didn't go to press until late Monday night. So you had a lot of time to work on stuff. Now, it's with the advent, especially of Twitter, everything is instantaneous. And, you know, people, for the most part, fans, if they choose to be, they can be a lot more educated than they were before because there's a lot more stuff they can read and there's a lot more information they can gather. On the other hand, fans can be very impatient and very unrealistic in what they expect. If you guys remember at the Daytona 500 this year, there were a couple of the Hendrick/Stewart-Haas cars that blew up in Sprint Cup practice. In the first Daytona 500 practice, on I guess it was Saturday. Saturday. There were a couple of Stuart Haas and Henry cars that had engine problems. And I get people hitting me up on Twitter, what happened to the engines? Well, they blew. And this is like 2 minutes after the second or third one blew. Well, I know that, but what specifically happened? And I'm like, guys, I have no way of knowing what specifically happened. I said, they have to go through, pull the engines out of the car and look at them and make a detailed determination of what happened. And then maybe they'll tell us, and then maybe they won't. But it's unrealistic. I mean, people were actually angry that, you know, 90 seconds had passed, and I couldn't tell them whether it threw a rod or broke a valve spring. And, you know, you run down to the garage, and I cornered Doug Dukart, who's the competition director at Hendrick, and he just looked at me and said, I'm not ready to talk now. When I know more, I'll get you. And, you know, an hour later, he debriefed with his engine guys and talked to a couple of his engineers, and they had some insight into what happened, and they talked to him. But, you know, people want information immediately now, and we do our best to get it to them. But there's sometimes a disconnect between what we can do and what we can't do.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you answering our question. You know, that really does bring up a lot of points, you know, out there. There are a lot of fans, as you say, they're very unrealistic in the way that the information age has allowed them to be, to sit at home behind their computers and ask questions, or, you know, even become the armchair quarterback on Sunday afternoons when something happens.
Well, I mean, in general, I love social media. It's great to get the feedback. It's great to know what fans are thinking. It's great every once in a while to tweak them, just to, you know, throw something out there to see what they'll say. And because one of the things that happens is what we think as writers and as insiders in the sport, how we see things and what we think about things don't always line up with the fans' concerns and interests. So it's nice to have that give and take and be more immediate. And I've made some good friends. I've met some incredibly nice people all across the country. And, you know, about 99% of the people I've met on social media have been wonderful. So on balance, it's very good.
And just one more real quick question about that.
Sure.
You know, with social media, you know, just being that instantaneous where people can put their opinions out there, ask you questions, ask drivers questions, you know, ask NASCAR questions and everybody in between, do you feel that that has kind of changed the perception in the sport on how they are changing not only the schedules but the cars and using that feedback from their side to see what the fans really do want, instead of having to, you know, rely on what only the drivers want?
Yeah, NASCAR has created something called the Fan Engagement Center, which is in the NASCAR Tower in Charlotte. And they very, very quickly monitor feedback from fans, and they follow the media very closely, too, to see what we're saying. And they do a very, very good and thorough job, and they try to be accommodating. You know, the two things I will say, though, sometimes you can go too far and let the tail wag the dog, because there can be three or four really loud voices on Twitter that aren't necessarily indicative of the larger fan sentiment. And you don't want to – there's been a little bit of pushback from fans – this year that I've heard from, that NASCAR has made so many changes to try and accommodate some of the things that fans said they were looking for. We now have fans going, whoa, 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 the racing's real good, let's keep everything the way it is for a while. So it's a tough place for NASCAR to be in sometimes.
Yeah, most definitely. Well, I appreciate you coming on and answering my questions tonight, and hopefully I'll see you at a racetrack one of these days.
I look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
All right. Mr. Jensen, can I ask you one quick question? Okay.
Absolutely.
I want to thank you for taking I want to thank you for taking time out to talk to me at the media center here in Talladega, and we just our little small radio show. Thank you very much, friend. But I've got a, you know, thank you. We've got a got Jimmy Johnson, our first three-time winner in the Chase. Do you think it's do you think we might see a four-time, five-time winner
between now and the Chase start?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could have. It wouldn't surprise me if Kevin Harvick has four or five wins when the Chase starts. It wouldn't surprise me if Jimmy Johnson has four or five. It wouldn't even surprise me if Dale Earnhardt or Joey Logano has maybe not five, but certainly three or four. I think what you're going to see over most of the summer is you're going to see guys who've won already win again. Because you're starting to see it now that the same guys who run up front every week or who won early in the season are running up front. You know, Harvick's had four or five finishes in the top three in the last 6 or 7 weeks. Keselowski's had finished second or third the last 3 weeks in a row. The Johnson's obviously won 3 out of 4. The guys who are running real well, those are the guys who are going to be winning races. Now, with that said, we go to the road course at Sonoma this week, where we've had 7 different winners in the last 7 races there. And all 7 of the guys who won at Sonoma in the last 7 years, that was their first NASCAR Sprint Cup road course victory. And I think you're going to see some guys really pull out all the stops because they know that's going to be their only chance to get in the chase. So we could have a new winner this week. But I really don't think we're going to have a whole lot of new winners over the summer. I think it's going to be the same guys winning again.
Yes, sir. I think so too, Tom. I don't think we're going to see 16 different winners. That's just not going to happen, you know, because me and you and Stephen and Jim, we've been around the sport that long. I just don't think we're going to see 16 different winners. I really don't. But, Tom,
no.
any last thoughts, Tom?
Please make sure your sound is on.
I think we've had some of the best racing in years this year, and I'm really excited about the possibility of the new Chase format. It's going to go down to the final race of the season no matter what. There's going to be 4 guys who have a chance to win. And I'm going to go on a not very far limb and say the 4 guys I think who are going to be there in no particular order are Johnson, Earnhardt, Harvick, and Keselowski. I think those are the guys, one of those 4 guys wins a championship this year.
Yes, sir. That is definitely good thoughts. And, Tom, myself and my wife, Suzanne, and Stephen and his wife, Anne-Marie, we will be in Richmond. Are you going to be in Richmond for the final race before the Chase?
Yes, sir, absolutely. I never miss that one. I'd love to hook up with you then.
Yes, sir, we will. We'll meet up in Richmond, bud. And, Tom, thanks a lot, my friend, for coming on and talking NASCAR from the sport that we love. And don't be a stranger, bud. I'll talk at you later.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Mr. Tom Jensen. And we've still got Mr. Jim Baldwin, hauler driver for Dale Earnhardt Sr. Jim, you have any last thoughts? I know we had you on the sidekick there for a little bit, but you got the floor, Jim. If you have any last thoughts before we go on, go ahead, bud.
Oh, thank you, Tim. No, I just think the racing has been really good this year. I think it may even get better as things go on. When teams get a little more acclimated to this new car and everything, I think it's going to be a really good year of racing, not only in Cup, but in the Nationwide Series. I think it's going to continue to get better.
Yes, sir, I do too. And, Stephen, any last thoughts from Mr. Jim Baldwin before we let him go?
Yeah, just one quick question for you, Jim. Any tracks out there that are no longer on the schedule you would like to see the NASCAR series, any of the series, go back to?
I would like to see 2 races at Darlington again. That is a great place. They have excellent races there, always have. I would like to go back to Rockingham again, but I know we never will. So out of the question, that won't happen. But I like Rockingham.
All right, well, thanks a lot. Appreciate you coming on tonight.
Anytime. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Baldwin. Don't be a stranger. I got your number. We'll get you back on.
Okay, thanks for having me. Anytime you need anything, call me.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Baldwin.
Okay, thank you, Tim.
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, that was, you ain't going to believe that. That was Dale Earnhardt Sr.'s hauler driver. I mean, you know, where else can you hear it but on the Speedway Digest Radio Network? Am I right, Stephen? My God.
Yeah, that was fun having him on there. You know, he's an interesting guy. You know, I've talked to him before out at the racetrack, and he's got a lot of cool stories out there to tell you from all his years, not only being on the road, but being there with Dale Earnhardt and being there with Richard Childress. So it's, you know, I like to hear some of those stories. I'm a bit of a history buff myself, and, you know, if it wasn't for the yesteryear of NASCAR, we wouldn't have the current, what we have right now, to be able to still sit and enjoy on Sunday afternoons.
You're exactly right, Stephen. And I want to bring Stephen. We got our weatherman. We got so many people calling out. I don't know what's going on here. Phone lines have lit up. Stephen, we've got our weatherman, Mr. Tim Campbell, from Stillwater, Oklahoma, with our race weekend forecast. We're going to bring Tim on, and then we've got Tony B, Indianapolis 500 Championship crew member. He won the Indianapolis 500 with Daryl Franken. We're going to bring him and Tina on here in just a minute. But let's bring Tim on and get your race weekend forecast for Sonoma.
Let's get ready to rumble!
My good friend, Mr. Tim Campbell from Stillwater, Oklahoma, with our race weekend for our weatherman. How you doing, bud? Are you there, Tim? Tim, can you hear me? I think Tim's breaking up. Can you hear me, Stephen?
Yeah, man, I got you. I think he's gone quiet on us here.
Okay, we'll put him back over here in mute. And we're going to bring on, I love this button. We're going to bring on Mr. Tony B. He's going to do his segment, Everything Open Wheel, and his sidekick, Miss Tina Stoll, NHRA drag racer. And Miss NHRA, Stephen. And, you know, me and you don't know that much about it. That's when we got them to come on. So we're going to bring him on. Here we go, bud.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Tony B, Miss Tina Stoll, how y'all doing this evening?
I'm doing good.
I'm doing good, too.
Okay, good. We're doing great. Y'all are in the pit stop with Timmy Spine and Stephen Wilson. Stephen Wilson, CEO of Speedway Digest on the Speedway Digest Radio Network. And we're going to let y'all do y'all's segment, which, you know, Tony's is Everything Open Wheel. And Stephen, we'll let them have the floor if that's okay with you, bud.
Yeah, that works for me. I don't have any questions for him tonight.
Oh, Stephen, okay. But you ought to have a bunch of questions. After Indiana Midget Week, and we were invaded by Australia, which was a good thing, the competition was so fine and so good, crowned Rico Averu the 2014 Indiana Midget Week champion, and the poor guy was racing with a broken collarbone that he sustained from a terrible safety device that broke his collarbone in a horrific crash. That's why I'm reaching out to everybody with Brace Yourself so we can help protect these guys and they can, you know, climb into a car and be aggressive and not have to worry about if they go a bit too far or get a little here or a little there, that they're going to climb out of that car and be all right. Rico showed me his unfortunately, he had to have surgery, and they actually removed part of that collarbone. So feel sorry for him, but he is making a good comeback. And, boy, did he ever put on a good show for the state of Indiana and Indiana Midget Week. And Australia and New Zealand was represented by four drivers. There were people from all over the world that came into Indiana for USAC and their Indiana Midget Week. And we're very much looking forward to Indiana Sprint Week, which starts in July.
Well, wow. Sounds, it's good to hear that he survived the crash. It's always, from a driver's standpoint, you get laxed and you get used to having your safety equipment do what it does, but it definitely throws you off when something doesn't do what it's intended to do. That's mighty scary from a driver's standpoint. Got to give a big applause to anybody who's willing to get back in the car after, a tragic wreck like that.
Well, he not only got her back in the car, but he had her up on the cushion, hammered down, and he had some upside down spills himself. But he done very, very well. And you know, I've been in motorsports for 35 years, and I know everybody knows his name. He is a very young man, Christopher Bell. At Lincoln Park Speedway, took one of the most horrific rides in a midget that I've ever seen. They did transport him to the hospital, but that young man was in another car the next night. And I guess it pays to be, not 21 yet and still young, because at 51, I think I'd been down for life after that ride. But I'm just telling you.
I can understand that. I can understand that. It seems the older you get, the more noise and crackles and pops that you hear when you hit the ground hard. That's for sure.
Well, I think it's because everything that was up high has gone down away from my ears, and I can hear and I can see, and whoa.
Well, I've always said it's like as I get older, man, my body's all the same. It's just not all in the same place.
Copy that, yeah. 10-4 there. The USAC National, AMSOI National Sprint Cars had been out on their Eastern run, and they are going to Nebraska, or check that, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. The 20th, the 21st, and 22nd, and that's very good. Good tour for them. Formula One goes to Austria. And my good old boys from Verizon IndyCar are headed to Houston. Tina, are you going to get to see that show?
I'm not. Unfortunately, I will not be around for it. Hopefully, I'll be out doing my own stuff, but... That'd be a kick thing to see. I'd love to come out and see how that, what that's all about. I'm sure it's quite a bit different than drag racing, but, there's something about motorsports that has a connectedness, I guess kind of like distant cousins kind of thing.
Absolutely. And they put on quite a show there. And, unfortunately, that's how we lost Dario Franchitti to, but he's doing a great job with media and letting people know about racing through media and still doing some help with Ganassi Racing. But he had a horrible crash in Houston, and it took him down. He has TBI, traumatic brain injury, and but he's doing really well, and he's a good guy, and he reaches out to a lot of people.
That's excellent, man. There's a certain breed of racer that you know the risks that go into it, but I think at deep level we all believe it's not going to happen to us, because you'd kind of be an idiot if you thought it was. But that's what keeps you going, is just the belief that your safety equipment and your team's going to make up for it. But unfortunately, the most talented, when things go wrong, they go wrong big.
Yes, they do. And talking about things going right, you know, I've been doing a little research on the Formula One World Championship, and when you look back starting in March with Nico Rosberg, he was in a Mercedes. Mm-hmm. The second race winner in a Mercedes, Lewis Hamilton. Third race, Lewis Hamilton in a Mercedes. Fourth race, Lewis Hamilton in a Mercedes. Fifth race, Lewis Hamilton in a Mercedes. Monaco, the sixth race, Nico Rosberg in a Mercedes. And I don't know where this guy come from in Canada, in that Renault, but he won. But Formula One is going to Austria June 21st and 22nd. So that'd be good watching, and I bet that's got a lot of people scratching their heads and doing their homework to put some other cars, because if you show up in a BMW, you kind of, you're in second place.
It sounds like the Mercedes has got, they're doing something right, definitely.
Absolutely.
Nan, how in the world do they travel over there with the entire team? Do they just, I mean, ship them by boat or?
Well, now I can tell you, when IndyCar, when we would go to Brazil or places such as that, all of our stuff was flown and flown together. You would have a day that you met at the airport, and you would unload your cars and your equipment, and that's the only day you got to do it. And so you made sure you did it right. And then it is flown over, as well as all the crew, the engineers, the mechanics, the owners, the drivers, exactly. You know, when you get back statewide, when you travel from one venue to another, mostly your mechanics, your engineers, your drivers, and your owners, they got a pretty good time schedule. But the guys that are driving the transports, they may go from one race to another, and it's very easy for them men and women to spend 300 days a year on the road.
I can imagine it. I can imagine. It's not, you know, you got to love the sport to do something like that, because it's long hours, long time away from home. But, you know, it's and they're probably massively overqualified for their position just to, you know, to get that, because I know that they pitch in a lot with, you know, everything and anything that's needed.
Everybody, you know, does everything.
You know, and it's to find that somebody that well-rounded that, you know, I mean, you can spend 10 years just training somebody. And, you know, if they get good, you know, somebody else is going to want to steal them away. But it's quite a life. I've always said, you know, you have to tell people all the time, or, you know, hey, I'll come help. I'll drive your stuff, da-da-da. And the first thing you got to tell them is you realize you'll never see another race again, you know.
Absolutely.
If people think, oh, yeah, you get to drive it to the race and then get to watch a free race, and I've yet to have anybody in my, you know, in a crew that ever actually has seen a race other than maybe when I'm going down the track for, you know, the 20 minutes that we're up there or whatever. It's game on time from the time you hit even between. I mean, it's game on time 24/7.
Absolutely. And, you know, the only high side was if you were done at one venue and the next venue was a road course and the venue you're on was a super speedway or an oval, you got to go through the shop and pick up the other cars. So, you know, those guys and gals spend a lot of time on the road and they work extremely hard. Those are, you know, when you go to the track, those are 12, 14, 16-hour days. And you do it for more than one day in a row. And God bless them all, and I appreciate what they bring to us.
Yeah. Well, definitely, it's an endurance job. I mean, they're, you know, just when the, you know, shoot, when the race is over, that's when the real work begins a lot of times.
You're absolutely right.
And, you know, and the thing is, there's such a reliance. Somebody forgets to throw tires in or whatever. There's not a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of recoup. You can't run down to the store and get another, you know, case of this or whatever. So a lot of people, these things just don't run unless everybody knows what they're doing and everybody carries their, you know, their part of the teamwork.
Well, an IndyCar, you didn't have to worry about tires because they all go back to Firestone. And the only tires that you're allowed to have in your hauler, your transporter, are tow tires. And so, you know, that's always a big job when you get to the track. You got to get the tires. And I was a tire specialist, and that's a big job.
So
and,
silly question, but are you issued, kind of like issued tires for that race?
Yes.
Hmm.
You have the specified tire for that race. You have the amount of reds and blacks that you're going to get, and you mount everything from day one, and then that's what you have to work with through practice, qualifications, and the race.
Wow. You know, that's entirely different from, you know, like NHRA. We all get our tires from the same, pretty much the same source. When you get to the pro level, they have one person who makes that particular tire. But because obviously we get passes out of them versus mileage, you know, you get a tire, and once you kind of break it in and know what track it's good on, they'll set those aside or they'll use them. You know, so you kind of bring your own supply, and you know the pre-race, you know which rollout is on each tire, and you know just how, what kind of track they like, so you can adjust those tires for every pass throughout the weekend.
Exactly.
But man, we don't have a quick enough learning curve. You know,
well, I can tell you,
if they gave us new tires,
like,
we'd all be lost. That's
500 when you get 35 sets of tires for the entire ordeal. You know, when you're, it's an ordeal.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a lot of work.
Hey,
it's a lot,
Tony.
Of fun. Yes, go ahead.
Tony, it's Tim.
Yeah.
So, sorry to interrupt you and Tina.
That's all right.
Hey, Stephen wanted to jump in. I think Stephen has a question. Go ahead, Stephen.
Okay.
No, I so much don't have a question, but I'll kind of give you all a little insight here on the way that it's done in NASCAR. Goodyear brings a tire to the racetrack, and they're specifically coded left and right. They also have RFID chips into them. So when the Goodyear engineers put them on the rims for the teams, they're coded out to the team, and at the end of the weekend, they're required to return them back, and they're coded back into Goodyear's system. Same way as you were talking about with Firestone, there are some tow tires that the teams are allowed, but the other thing, the other aspect of it is that Goodyear publishes an engineering spec sheet three or four days before the race, and it will tell you what your code tires are for the left and right, how many sets of tires you're allotted for practice, qualifying, and for the race day.
Absolutely. That you are spot on correct. And I can tell you, if Firestone is not paying enough attention to you, have an incident to where a tire is severed or split, and let me tell you, you cover those quickly, and Firestone takes them away quickly because they do not want anybody to see what that tire is made of.
Yeah, that's the same way that Goodyear does. You just take a look at this past weekend. Brian Vickers on the first lap of the race, the tire shredded on his car coming out of turn three and turn four. The next thing you saw on TV was a Goodyear engineer picking that thing up and hauling that thing
absolutely
right back to the hauler.
Yes. Yeah. They want them, and they want them quick. And from what I've been told, somebody that is trained and educated can look at the interior of that and tell you how it's made and what it's made of. And that's big business. And Firestone does a great job, and so does Goodyear with NASCAR and the Hoosier tires with USAC are phenomenal as well. They all do a good job.
Yeah, most definitely. They all do a good job out there, you know. Just kind of, I guess that kind of brings up one good question for me. You know, there's a lot of people in NASCAR that say, or even all sports, that say, well, there's only one manufacturer putting out these tires for the weekend. You think it would be a good idea for teams to be allotted to bring in a secondary manufacturer for the weekend?
I personally, now this is me personally, I would like to see that just as I like to see other drivers come in because of their talent and their abilities. And a lot of times that is how it's decided. And then engineering, you know, they get to hire the people they want for engineering. So I believe that there are some major manufacturers of race tires, Firestone, Bridgestone, Continental, Hoosier, Goodyear. And I think that all should be able to run every race and it be decided by the car owners, the crew chief, and the drivers, what they want to run on.
It's common, you know, common practice. You learn it in economics. When you have competition, you get a better product at a lower price. You get that somebody who's going to want an edge, and we've seen it when you allow different, you know, when we have, you know, everything from, like, pro stock bikes. We got Harley now going up against, you know, the bikes that were there forever, and sure enough, they found improvements that they could make in that. And when you have two tire companies that can come in, you know, they're not going to be able to give them six weeks' notice and have them be able to produce something. But when you make it, as long as it passes an SFI, you know, a safety rating, and it's rated safe for the race, it should be up to the teams, because that's where you're going to get your advantage, are those little choices that you make back and forth. Nobody's going to force you to use the tire you don't want, but it allows them to pick which is the best tire. There are a lot of times in NHRA where they've been forced to pick one device over another because there was only one of them was certified or whatever, and you're stuck with it. And it's not until there's the weaknesses come out and safety issues come out when something fails. It's this year we had an issue where NHRA, there were, you know, these especially the funny cars are just going up like grenades. And so somebody at, you know, at the top decided, well, what we really need to do is strap these bodies down so that it, when they implode, the body doesn't go flying up in the air. Well, the first thing they learned after the first couple explosions was that they were containing that explosion in with the driver.
Exactly.
And these drivers were getting their bells rung. And I know there were some drivers who, they saw this, the crew chief saw it, they were complaining, they were saying, this isn't what we want to do, but because they thought, oh, you know, this is going to make it safer for the spectators, and they probably had, I mean, they had good intentions, but without the fact that a lot of them don't actually drive these cars, you know, sure enough, we found out, well, maybe it's not that good idea to strap this thing down. Maybe it's better to have that explosion go somewhere. And then we saw them backing off of these strapping ideas. But a lot of this stuff that gets put into play, and we've seen it with different safety equipment. You know, it's not until the guinea pigs, who are not the people making the decision, the drivers, are getting, you know, it's their life, and yet they're not even given a choice as to whether or not this modification has, you know, been better. You have the engineers or whatever that are making good estimated guesses about, you know, changing the fuel mix or this or that, but they don't have the practical experience of what actually happens when those decisions are made.
And I think, you know, that's kind of like, that's where I always say that NASCAR is, you know, top A when it comes to that. Everybody that works in that R&D center there in Concord, North Carolina, they are racers. They are former competitors. They are engineers. So they do take those cars out there and they crash them and bang them up and blow them up and do everything conceivable that they can do before they put that product out on the racetrack. And, you know, they do one heck of a job out there with the, with that R&D center. But, you know, just kind of going back to the tires is, you know, when you've got Goodyear out there that's competing every single week, they're telling you what left and what right side codes that you're going to run, how many sets of tires that you can pass. You know, competition is good. You can't, they don't mandate anybody out there in the field to say you're going to run a Toyota, a Chevy, or a Ford motor. But, you know, they mandate them down to the tires. And Hoosier makes a very good oval track tire. They've been around for many years, and they're not, they know what they're doing. So they would be an obvious competitor to be able to get back into NASCAR and give some of these teams a choice on what they're running on the weekends.
Well, definitely. You know, it comes down, though, to that, you know, that the team should be making those choices, you know. And I think, you know, I always baffles me when you have, you know, because the team's going to do whatever's most competitive, you know. But point well made.
I agree with you, Tina and Stephen. As long as the manufacturer is SFI approved and you're not putting a driver at risk, and these are good quality tires, I think that they should be open to that avenue to run what tire they wish. I do agree with them aerodynamically, the cars being the same, the motors being the same. I agree with that. And then put it in the driver, the tires, and the crew chief and the engineer's hands. And anybody that doesn't think an engineer has more to do with how these cars run today, in every aspect, it is monitored. And the engineers are fabulous. And that's one thing that racing needs today is engineering. And I wish the fans and people knew just exactly how engineered these cars are and what they are monitoring and how they change things and how they get that feedback. And, you know, when I would put tires on an Indy car, I knew what they were set at. As soon as that car rolled, my engineer knew if I did my job right or wrong. And when you've got a driver that's going into a corner at 230, 240 miles an hour at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you got to do a good job. And I did do that. But, you know, the engineers know it all. And if they say they want other tires, I think they should give them to them.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I think we can make a lot of arguments to allow, you know, multiple competition as far as that's concerned. I mean, not only in the aspect that, you know, as I said, you know, nobody forces anybody to run, you know, a Ford, a Chevy, a Honda, a Toyota, whatever it may be in your series. You know, we can make a lot of good arguments as far as that's concerned. But one of the biggest things I think it really comes back down to is that, you know, when you take a look at Goodyear and you take a look at Firestone and Continental and some of these other tire manufacturers, they pour a lot of money to ensure that they are the only ones out there. And that, unfortunately, you know, reflects on the decision of, you know, what these guys run on the weekends.
Yes, absolutely. Tim, to throw out a good job to one of your fellow people that have been on the radio show, from Gateway Motorsports Park, USAC Silver Crown Cars raced there on June the 14th with Bobby Santos bringing home the gold. And they also had the NASCAR Camping World Truck Series run there the same day, and I got to give it out. I don't know how to say his last name, but I got to give it out to Gateway Motorsports Park for the event that they put on.
That would be Curtis Franconis.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Stephen. Thank you.
Yep, that's it, Stephen. Thank you. I mean, because you know how my redneck buddy is here in Talladega, Alabama. If it ain't a solid last name, I can't pronounce it. And I'm sorry, y'all. Y'all can laugh at me.
Well, I've tried to teach you how to say mine, but I don't know if we've got there it or not, but I will be visiting Alabama and seeing you and Steven in hand, and I guarantee you one thing, y'all know how to say it when we're done.
That's right, Tony. Yeah, and Tina, you know, you're I'm not going to say new, but, you know, because we've been friends on Twitter and everything, but yeah, Stephen Wilson and his wife, Anne-Marie, are coming down to stay with me and Suzanne for the fall race in Talladega. And Tony B and his wife, not wife, sorry, Tony, your girlfriend, Miss Jen.
She just got married.
Sorry about that, Tony. I didn't mean to say
that. It's
yeah.
Fiance right now.
Well, no pressure there, Tony, no pressure.
Well, you guys put the pressure on her. It's a money thing, I think. It's got a lot.
But, yeah,
Tony. She's Firestone, and I'm Goodyear, and she's not allowed to run in my race yet.
I think that's called blackmail, Tony. That's some blackmail there.
Hey, it's in the rule book. I live, love, and race, but I follow the rules.
Well, my question is, before you consider marrying a woman, there's one important question. Can she back a trailer?
Uh-oh.
Well...
You can date whoever you want, but always marry a woman who can back a trailer.
If she can't change tires while I'm working on it and make me bacon at the same time, I don't even want to talk.
There you go. Deal killer there. So all the ladies out there need to, like, get up to speed, you know. Yeah, a few basics here.
It's more, you know, she's got it going for her because she does farrow pigs. Yeah, she's a pig farmer. And that helps support my bacon problem because I love eating bacon.
Hey, Tony, y'all are freaking killing me. Tony, Tina, can I butt in for 1 second? I think we've got Tim Campbell back on. I want to bring. Let me see if Tim's back. You know, Tim's our weatherman from Stillwater, Oklahoma. He does the race weekend forecast. Let me see if Tim's here.
Okay.
Tim, can you hear me, son?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, got you. Sorry about all that. We lost you. You're in a pit stop with Tammy Spain and Stephen Wilson and Tony B and Miss Tina Stoll, NHRA drag racer. And sorry we had to wait so long, but if you want to do the race weekend forecast for Sonoma, you got the floor, bud.
Okay, looks like the whole weekend we're looking at low 70s to mid 80s during the daytime and mid 40s to low 50s during the evening. And I don't see any rain or nothing, or it's just about that way the whole weekend, Friday through Sunday.
That sounds great. You still haven't got no snow for Steven, have you?
No, I can't find him any.
Golly,
I would like to take. Tell everybody to ask everybody to please keep that Phil Gore, Nebraska. They had a tornado hit that town last night, and it just wiped it just about completely out. And I'd like to ask everybody to keep that town and the people who live there in prayers because they need all the help they can get. And they're talking like they may get hit again tonight with some wind and hail, maybe not tornadoes, but wind and hail. And they had two fatalities and like 24 critically injured, and one of them was a little kid, so you know, we hate to see that. And
wow.
So they just need all the prayers they can get.
Yes, sir. Prayers are going out from everybody here on the show and all of our listeners and
absolutely.
The Stupid Digest Radio Network. Yeah, they are, Tim. But is there any other bad weather or anything else going on besides out there? Now, Tim, was that where that double tornado touchdown I've been seeing on social media and Weather Channel and everything, was that where that double one touched down?
Yeah, that was in Pilgore. It was two EF4s, they said. They was like a mile and a half wide, each one of them. And the picture I seen of it looked like there was a road right down between them. And there's one on each side, and they said that's the first time they'd seen two sister tornadoes like that at one time, that big. But, I mean, they said the worst damage was out in the cornfield, but they did hit the town and just about tore it completely up. But, they said the worst of it was while it was outside in a cornfield. So God was looking over them out there for a little bit and calmed it down a little bit before it got into town, before it just wiped the whole town out. And but they did a – I watched a video this morning. The Nebraska Highway Patrol did a flyover deal in a helicopter, and they were showing the devastation there. And it, you know, there was a few houses standing, but there wasn't very many.
Golly, I hate that.
And we got they're headed down towards Chicago tonight, and they said earlier I hadn't seen any pictures yet, but they've seen the Angus, Canada, up and on by Ontario. They said it got wiped out by a tornado today sometime. I hadn't seen any pictures. I just heard about it.
Yeah, golly, Tim. I hate that. What is the, if you don't mind, Tim, what's the hot spots tonight, you know, where you can share with our listeners and everybody that, you know, might want to take cover?
Yeah, it's going to be Wisconsin and down in Chicago and back in Nebraska again. It's about the same path it took last night. It's going to start in Nebraska and then go on down and into Chicago. But they said it's not going to be Nebraska. They said you shouldn't get the tornadoes tonight. They said it'd probably just be high wind and hail. But they may not get any tornadoes tonight, but it's going to take the same path it did last night, so... You know, they're still searching for people and doing cleanup and stuff, and they really don't need to get hit by wind and hail tonight.
No, sir, they don't. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, just like Tim said, we want to send our thoughts and prayers out to everybody that's been affected by this. And Tim, if you want to talk a little bit about what you do, which I know you and your wife, y'all are storm spotters in Stillwater, Oklahoma, if you want to talk about your website and all that, you got the floor, friend.
Okay, yeah, I've been a trained weather spotter for about 20 years now, and weather is my passion. That's what I do. And my wife, she's a photographer, and she's a trained weather spotter, and we go out together and we take pictures. And I work on radar most of the day and about half the night, and making sure everybody and out the whole United States I watch radar for, and we try to warn people and get the warnings out. And I'm doing I got a website. My website is www.skywarnweather.weebly.com, and you can check it out. It's got all the warnings and stuff on there and the forecast and everything.
Okay. And Tim, I want to thank you again for coming aboard the Speedway Digest Radio Network with Tim Spain and Stephen Wilson, and you know, being our weather guy. I mean, you know, a lot of us work and we don't have really time, but I see your post every now and then, and I want to thank you for posting on mine and Stephen's fan pages and that stuff. And but yeah, thank you again, bud. And I hate to cut you short, but we're getting close to the end, and I want to let Tina and Tony have their time and let, Tina talk about some NHRA. But thanks again, my friend. We're all with you, bud.
Oh, okay.
All right, thanks, bud.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, Tony and Steven and Tina, thank you for letting me bring him in. He come on earlier and dropped. But, yeah, Tony knows Tim. You know, Tony's talked to Tim. Tim Campbell, Stillwater, Oklahoma, he has agreed to be our official weatherman for the show, and that's, you know, pretty cool. You know, we get to race weekend forecast. But, you know, just like Tim said, you know, it's hard to forecast it, you know, as far as Tuesday to Sunday, and he posts everything on the Speedway Digest Radio Network. He puts everything out. He keeps it up. And I want to thank him for doing that, because I mean, Tim is steady in it. But anyway, sorry, but thank y'all for letting me break in. Tony, I'm going to give it back to you and Tina. And we've got 25 minutes, so y'all go, and me and Steven will listen.
Okay, go, Tina.
Well, I kind of a quick breakdown about NHRA this weekend. They were out in Bristol, Tennessee, and running that race, and we had some pretty good racing. You know, nice to have some weather that worked with us. It seems like we've been just a rain magnet this whole season. But in Funny Car, we had Tommy Johnson Jr. Win in the Funny Car category. He had a pretty stiff day. He started out with Wilkerson, then Hagen in round two. Robert Height was right there in round three, and he ended up by taking home the Wally. Over in the Pro Stock next, Erica Anders, who has just been racing fantastically this year. She is running for Richard Freeman, who raced last year. This year he's sitting back as a team owner for the Elite Motorsports. She went up against Larry Morgan first round, lucked out, got Greg Anderson, Jed Coughlin, two guys you don't want to see in the other lane. Both of them red-lit against her. And then she had Johnny Gray in the final and did her job and went down there with a 669 and got the Wally for Pro Stock. And then last we had Top Fuel. And our winner was Sean Langdon. Now, Sean, he's a young man. He's in his early 20s. I started racing against him when he was down in Super Comp. And I'll tell you, that boy can cut a light. Super Comp, where we can control our lights and with delay and stuff, he was a 001 to 005 every time. And it looks like he has not changed. His lights were, you know, pretty much dead on within about six thousandths of a second between them. The pros, they run about a 70 light is what their car reaction time is, and so he ran had a 71, 70, and a 65. Just an awesome driving job, and ended up by winning it with a 3902 in that final, and got the Wally for that team. So it was a good weekend of racing. I'll tell you, just having some decent weather was a huge relief. You know, he's talking about predicting the weather, and I'll tell you, man, it's you can't guess it right 5 minutes in. We've been fighting it this year with rainouts, and you know, when that weather changes, the track changes so quickly that it can be really dicey. And we did see a lot of people having problem getting traction down the track, but you know, overall, it was a great weekend of racing.
Good deal. What's Tony Schumacher doing these days? He's my favorite.
Well, he runs for the Army team. He's had a pretty good year. There was a couple of years when he just, you know, was untouchable. But that Top Fuel, it has been nobody by any means has run away with it this year. There have been some teams that have struggled more than others. You know, but with, you know, considering that there's not a huge amount of turnover in drivers, there's not a lot of turnover in teams, you know, he's always at the top of that pack.
Awesome. And John Force, is this his last year, or he's still on board for a while?
Well, you know what, I really think if he were even considering stepping out of the car, we would be hearing rumors of it and such. You know, losing that Ford sponsorship was huge, and I think without that John Force name, to, you know, try to attract a new sponsor would probably be pretty difficult. He's got excellent drivers. His daughters have turned out to be great drivers. Robert Height, his son-in-law, excellent drivers. If he wanted to step out, there are definitely in his camp, he already has a driver that's totally ready to step in. But, you know, there's that, you know, taking the driver and taking him out of the seat is a hard transition. I've talked to several who have gone transition from, you know, driving to race owner and, you know, becoming just the part of the management. And some transition really well, some don't. I think John is, you know, he's always been, you know, in it. There was, you know, I think if he was going to step out of his car, it would have probably happened after his bad wreck at Dallas a few years back. that was a, it took quite a bit of time. I think it was about 6 months at least for him to recover from that. His injuries were pretty significant. And, you know, that you could see the taxing. I think probably the heaviest thing that changed with that accident was that he had never had a – he hadn't had a serious accident before, and that invincibility, you know, that bubble burst, and the reality that, hey, you know, you can – that even he could get hurt doing this. You know, and but he's back in full, you know, strong. And, you know, dang it, he's still out there winning. And, you know, there's – it's, you know, you kind of like – I think any good thoroughbred doesn't want to give up the fight until they have to. So I think he'll be out there for a couple more years.
Good deal.
And as far as NHRA, when is Brace Yourself going to be able to put a safety device on you and get you back racing?
Well, you know, everything I've looked at on it, man, it just seems like it's probably a great improvement over what we have right now, just because it doesn't limit the ability for performance. And from a driver standpoint, that I'll tell you, getting in those cars and being that tight and bound down, there's that claustrophobic thing. And when you feel like you're being restricted and you can't, you know, your movement is really difficult, or you can't turn your head, or those kind of things, I would tend to really not like that. You know, a lot of the guys, you know, right now, it's like one of the hardest things to get these guys to do is to even use their safety equipment appropriately. A lot of the guys, you know, they'll wear the belts loose, and we've seen, you know, how significantly bad a decision that can be. So hopefully, you know, once it gets that SFI rating down, I'll be probably the first one in.
Well, and the nice thing about it is you are going to be able to turn your head. You
yeah.
are going to be able to withstand a side impact
mm-hmm.
as well as a frontal or a rear. And it is going to protect your head and your neck. And it doesn't require the belts to make it work. So if you're
yeah.
under G-force and your belt's loosened, your equipment is still going to work for you. So
well,
we're looking forward
you know,
to that.
And part of it, for like from my perspective, is that there are like, you know, you have 16 pro racers. You have 16 top fuel. You have 16 funny car. Typically, we have a full field, maybe 18. That's a very small number of racers. Sportsman racers, we're now, you know, we're in, I think, last year in Super Comp, where we're running anywhere from 170 to 190, that's a significant amount of speed if you're flipping. And these cars do flip, and they get out of control. We're not required to wear other than a neck roll, we're not required to wear something similar to most people would know, like the Hans device, which is what the Brace Yourself is. But we need to, because these sportsmen, we're going at speeds that are, you know, they haven't had it in the past, because when I started racing even just 14 years ago, at 150, 170, that's about as fast. We've got guys that are going top sportsmen and stuff that are going even 200, and we have thousands of racers across the country. I mean, there are thousands. In Super Comp alone, just those who are racing at the NHRA level, which by far is only a small percentage of racers in general, you know, there's 1,200 competing for, you know, one first place winner of the season. But that's quite a few of things. We don't have, you don't see a lot of wrecks and stuff in our category, but they're only looking at one race that's happening, where each weekend almost every track across the United States is having some form of racing going on. And you know, it's you know, they're like any sport, there is always risk of injury, whether it's football, soccer, or motorsports. But anytime you can limit it and you can have unnecessary permanent damage, this is something that's really got to be looked at.
Absolutely. And I will tell you, when I raced down to Alabama to be with Stephen Wilson and his wife and Tim Despain and his wife, I'll be wearing one on the interstate. So y'all better look out, because I'm going to be safe. brace yourself, live, love, race, and I'm headed to Alabama.
Well, that's good,
that,
Tony.
Jimmy?
But yes, sir, I love it. But, you know, the one thing, and I'm sure I brought it up before, Suzanne said she wants to put that Indianapolis 500 championship ring on her finger one time.
Well, and I told her, and I will let her do that. I have two of them, one for winning the Indianapolis 500 and one for winning the pit stop competition with Izod at the same Indianapolis 500. I let her, one is 11.5, the other is 12. I figure we can get them on her, both her big toes and take a picture.
That sounds good. Are you... You might can put three fingers up in there and slide it over that, but she is tickled to death, Tony, about y'all coming down. And,
I am looking forward to putting the rings on Steven and his wife, and I want pictures of those. Those are great memories, and you and Suzanne, and Tina as well, and great, very fond memories, and very blessed to have those.
Yes, sir, you are, Tony. And Tony, I want to thank you again for being a part of the Pit Stop Radio on the Speedway Digest Radio Network. And Tina has come aboard now, and you know she does. Which we've got her with you right now, but she's going to eventually do. We know we might get y'all a show. We'll talk to Steven.
Well,
them drag
racers so fast, so she's loving to speed away from me fast and have her own show.
I might be able to speed away, but I'm going to have to stop to fill up for gas about every 2 miles. So it kind of evens itself out.
Okay. You're
That's good. That's good. And, again, Tina, thank you very much. And any last thoughts? We're coming up on the end here. Tony, let me let Tina have the floor for here in a minute. Any last thoughts, Ms. Tina, about NHRA or your sponsorships, if you want to throw out there?
Well, I'll tell you. I'm having a blast in the show. I'll throw my 2 cents in like any good woman will. And whether you agree with me or disagree with me, let me know either way. But enjoying just being able to talk a little bit about my sport, and, you know, hopefully we can get, you know, some people cross over where, you know, there is a bloodline that runs through all motorsports. And, you know, when you sit back and watch it on TV or from the stands, it doesn't look that similar. But, you know, you start to talk and you start to find out a little bit about this and this, and there's so much crossover information and so many things we do alike and so many things we do different, because it's almost as though, you know, if you look at, like, you know, NASCAR or something, it's real important how you get out of that pit. Well, we're just getting out of the pit and going to the other end of the track, and that's it. So it's like we have been hyper vigilant about that acceleration in the beginning of the race. You have other races that, you know, that are, you know, they're worried about turns and all that. I mean, I'm just blown away at the precision and the importance of every little detail. And no matter what kind of motorsports you're talking about, these are not, you know, your buddies out at the garage running out there doing the best and driving just fast. Driving fast is easy. Driving well and driving with skill and having those people, I mean, to me, I am blown away at what happens behind, you know, without the driver. You know, if you don't have a crew that knows what they're doing, I don't care if you could put the best driver in the world out there, they can't win without having their car be everything that they are. So there's just so much about all of this that just absolutely intrigues me, and that's what pulled me into my sport. But I know I'm going to miss out next week. I'm not going to be able to catch up. I'm going to be out golfing for Beacon House up in Michigan, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Beacon House provides a place for guys to stay while they're getting chemotherapy or medical right there in Marquette, and we'll be out there. I'll be out there with, like, Steve Marucci, and the guys from Deadliest Catch are going to be out there. So we'll be out there golfing for a couple days next week, and then I'll be back the following week. So try not
that
to miss
sounds good,
too much.
Tina. We're not, Tina. And I want to thank you again for coming aboard and being a part of, you know, me and Steven started this show as a NASCAR show, and then Tony come on, and then we got our weatherman, and it's just a complete motorsports talk show now. with, you know, Tony with Andy with Open Wheel and you with NHRA. I want to thank you again for being a part of it. And, you know, I don't know what else to say. Thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you. Y'all have a good weekend.
Yes, ma'am. You too. Tony B., any last thoughts? We're coming up on the end.
No last thoughts. Just want to remind everybody that there is a big weekend coming for the Verizon IndyCar Racing. They will be in Houston. The Formula One teams will be in Austria. The USAC National Sprint Cars will be in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And there's a lot of good things happening, and I am so blessed to be a part of this program and be friends with Stephen Wilson and Tim Despain. You guys do a remarkable job, put a lot of information out there, and I get a lot of feedback from people at the track. And I spent the last 3 days out talking to drivers about Brace Yourself, about the pit stop, and Stephen Wilson and Tim Despain. And you guys would be surprised, the drivers that I associated with, they know of our show, they know of you people, they know of Speedway Digest. That is a huge hit. And, you know, when you can talk to people like Michael Pickens and Tracy Hines and Rico Abreu, Brian Clausen, who just signed another IndyCar deal for the 2015 year. Congratulations to him. These people know of you guys. They know of our show. They listen. And they're going to be very anxious at getting on the show in the future. So thank you for everything that you guys do. Thank you, Tina Stahl. Thank you, Suzanne, for doing the radio show. I appreciate you all. And that's all I have this week, and I am really, really looking forward to next week. I'd like to thank you guys and Brace Yourself for allowing me to be here.
You're very welcome, Tony. And we want to, myself and Suzanne and Stephen Wilson, we want to thank you for being such a good friend and everything you do for Paul Cleveland and Brace Yourself, everything you do for the radio show. We appreciate it. And can I hit the button just one time, Tony?
One time you can.
Okay, one time. Don't get mad and come down here and whoop my butt, but I love doing this, Tony. Here we go.
Say hello to my little friend.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Tony. But, yeah, Tony, you're mine and Suzanne's bodyguard, and I'm pretty sure you'll be Stephen's bodyguard. But anyway,
absolutely.
But thank you for Thank you very much. We're coming up on the end here, and I don't know what to say. I mean, everything's getting bigger. The phone lines is blowing up, and Stephen Wilson's doing a great job. And
yes, he
Tony
is.
B, I'll talk at you later, my friend. I'll talk at you
All
later,
right,
buddy.
Y'all have a good evening. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Suzanne. Bye now.
Yes, sir. You're welcome.
That's all, folks. That's all, folks.